even a formal logical fallacy. And then, of course, there. But I don't. You know. Anyway, that's what I think about it at this point. Yeah. I'll just say this, that I have never run across what seems to me to be a very convincing discussion of the relation between psychoanalysis and dialectical materialism. I think certainly there's some interesting observations in the early Reich. To my way of thinking, Eros and Civilization, Marcuse's work, is much more, actually much more stimulating and much richer. But see, I mean, there's a basic, at least it appears to me, there's a basic problem in even approaching, theoretically, looking at the thing. In every psychoanalytic thinker, I believe this is true, and this certainly includes Reich, there's an underlying assumption that the drive structure, that there's essentially a human nature that consists of a certain drive structure, which drive structure is then molded and pummeled and modeled through a process of socialization. Now, in one sense, this, of course, is quite true. But, you see, it depends on the assumption, though, that at some point you can separate, you can at least theoretically separate this basic inherent drive structure from the socialization process, from what the society imposes on the individual. Now, if I'm not mistaken, underlying what any kind of developmental psychology or something like that, of a Marxist sort, if it would be consistent with dialectical materialism, would have to make quite a different. Have a different conception of this relation. That is, that there is no point at which you can theoretically separate something like the instinct or drive structure of the individual from the socialization process. That, of course, at some point it begins, in the case of each individual in time. But that the instincts and the drives are themselves thoroughly and totally historical in character because they are shaped and mediated. See, by the whole of human history that's recapitulating the socialization of each individual. Now, it's not easy to make this difference absolutely clear, but I think this is one thing that's involved. So in every psychoanalytic thinker that I've run across, there's always this, asserting itself, this notion that somehow or another there is in the id or someplace, there is some unsocialized, not simply the dialectical negation of the socialized that Freud really defines the id as being. That is, that part of me that defies, the id is created through the process of repression. But that back behind that, there is this unsocializable drive structure that's protesting and raising up against the whole socialization process. And I don't see how this is, it would... If something like this is true, then it seems to me historical materialism is false. And I don't know that the evidence, either clinical or experimental or otherwise, actually forces any conclusion like this. Rather, it was exactly a brilliant theoretical construct of Freud's that has very clear ideological, that has roots in bourgeois society. Yeah.
How would you answer the bourgeois philosopher's charge that the philosophy of Marxism is just another variant of the great spirit theory of history?
Well, in a dialectical sense, it is. I mean, all right. I'm not ashamed of having Hegel as an intellectual forerunner. The only way I answer it is by trying to, you know, as a Marxist, is by trying to give a criticism of Hegel. You see, if some bourgeois philosopher tells me that I'm an Hegelian, then that's his business, you know, to classify the thing the way he wants to. What I am, see, I'm a Marxist and concerned with is, you know, as a Marxist philosopher, is my relation to Hegel. Now, if someone wants to read what Marx has to say about Hegel and say Marx is really an Hegelian, it's all right. And in a sense, it's true. And if someone wants to say that, wants to try to undertake and expose in Marxism, this is a more serious point, expose in Marxism an underlying teleology or something of that sort, then this would be useful work if it could be done. It's been tried, I think, and it's never been done successfully. See, but the burden of proof is on whoever makes the charge. Now, partly it's like people who like to say that Marxism is a secularized Christianity or a secularized Judaism, an eschatology, so on and so on. Now, in one sense, of course, this is perfectly true. It's unlikely that Marxism would have assumed just the form that it did if it had not arisen within the framework of an intellectual tradition determined largely by Christianity. The same thing can be said of anything else that happened in the West. What they mean, you know, specifically, is that, all right, partly in the prophetic tradition, partly in the Christian eschatological tradition, you have the expectation of the imminent end of things, you know, or the coming of the second coming and so on and so on. And there's no question you can establish a historical continuity through the left wing of the Reformation, through Thomas Münzer, in some sense, in the revolutionary tradition, straight to Marxism. It's true, and I don't think any Marxist should be ashamed of it. But you see, what's involved when people raise the question that way, when they say that Marxism is simply a secularization of the eschatological tradition, is they're saying it's not merely a secularization. They're saying the eschatological tradition is the true thing, and Marxism is the false version. Whereas I think a Marxist can turn around and say, yes, we are the secularization of the eschatological tradition and of the religious tradition. That is to say, what Marxism does is to preserve the truth of Christianity and the truth of the Christian expectation. In other words, there's no reason, to give any more of intellectual history than has to be given to the theologians and idealists and people like that. A lot of it can be reclaimed, which is correct. It should be.
Anyway, I just wanted to relate something, an argument that I had one time that I was listening to that I had tried myself about people not, that you can only be sure that you are, you know, type of thing, you know. And I had gotten so sick and tired of this thing. What the hell difference would it make anyway, whether anybody else was or not? I can only rely on my senses.
Well, am I supposed to comment? I mean, I don't think there's any purely theoretical refutation of skepticism or of solipsism. You know, if someone wants to believe that the whole world is a figment of his imagination, then I have no particular reason to quarrel with him. I'm serious. I would only comment that at least I have enough control over my imagination, though, so that those things that are figments of my imagination, I can make do what I want to without effort. So I would ask him if he could test. I would like to see him test in practice, not denying that the whole world is a figment of his imagination, but his power of control over his imagination, by asking him to step in front of a moving automobile and imagine the consequences away. So what for me, you see, would become a practical test of knowledge, for him would be simply a psychological test of the extent of his obsessiveness. That is, the extent to which his imagination is in the grip of powers that he cannot control. But really, we're talking about the same thing, I suppose. Yeah?
The question has been raised on the foundations of mathematics, and the question is pretty half an hour old, so I thought I'd say very little except to point out that there's a distinction between the historical growth of mathematics, of course, which is based upon reality and based upon needs of, for example, you started at Newton. I don't know why you started at Newton. You can start with any period of recorded history and go backwards from there, where the Egyptians figured out the 3-4-5 right triangle so that they could lay out the land, plots of land after the flood. The point is that the introduction of mathematical logic, I hate to use it, it's frequently referred to as formal logic, and I think there's some confusion over the question of what mathematical or formal logic is. But when we talk about metamathematics, it should be very clear as to what we're talking about, and to say that the program of basing all of mathematics upon metamathematics distorts the whole program of metamathematicians. And being a metamathematician, I'm somewhat upset by that. And I would say, in all honesty, that we were brought, I mean, metamathematicians were, so to speak, brought into existence when we had Cantor's contradictions, we had Russell's contradictions, we had any one of a whole host of problems. We had confusion in the 19th century between the symbol and the thing it stood for. Newton, who invented the calculus, didn't have the slightest idea why it worked. And neither did Leibniz, who wrote the differential equations to each other to see who was smartest in solving these things. Now, I mean, in all seriousness, the metamathematical program, of course, has been tremendously successful in model theory, for example. Well, I could go on. The Turing machine is a model of the computer. The Gödel theorem that shows that there are certain inaccessible problems, truths, so to speak, mathematical truths, inaccessible to formal systems. That's a very important contribution, both to the field of philosophy and to the field of mathematics. And then Gödel further, like you said, I think in a, almost, well, I would say a slander against the development of modern set theory. I refer to Gödelian's Zermelo set theory, particularly as expounded in his book on the consistency of the action of choice. You confound that and confuse this with the intuitive set theory, which is internally contradictory, and which in the space of four lines, literally, you can show that the whole system of that arithmetic has collapsed. Now, this is what we were faced with, certainly, at the turn of the century. And, of course, Bertrand Russell spent quite a bit of time trying to develop a set theory in which these contradictions could be avoided, and he didn't make it. Right? Gödel did. And now, I could go on from there, but I think that one thing that we all recognize as Marxists is that the contributions made in this field by metamathematicians, and even, I'm excluding the intuitionists, incidentally, their contribution, I think it's a negative, mathematicians. Nevertheless, their contributions, of course, have been gone hand in glove with the developments of science, and literally are providing us with the weapons, or one of the set of weapons that we need to transform society. And that we don't throw out mathematical logic, we don't throw out metamathematics in toto, which of course is even greater, by any manner of means. The questions which Mr. Langston is dealing with is how do you take an abstract chess game, which mathematics in many cases is reduced to, and give it content? Well, in the process of giving it content, in other words, taking some formula on the board and interpreting the symbols, this is the process that he's talking about here. This is the question of the dynamic rather than change. The whole question of the fixity of categories and all these questions, which are very important to consider. We shouldn't get mixed up here in a discussion of metamathematics. And I think I'll sit down.
Comment on some of the basic political errors you
obvious one being maybe the identification of all nationalism is in reaction there.
Yeah, I think there's a, you know, you can, suppose you have a little model, say. Remember right towards the beginning of the permanent revolution, in the first few pages there, Trotsky quotes, it's a very striking thing, he quotes Stalin, in which Stalin says something to the effect that what is metamathematics?
Well, all right.
No, I don't care. I mean.
Well,
all right. Stalin says something like the laws of capitalism are the development of capitalism are universal. They operate, however, under conditions of national peculiarity. Therefore, while there is a single strategy of the World Revolutionary Workers Movement, there must be modifications of this with respect to the national peculiarities. Now, this is an innocent enough sounding thing. I'm sure there are laws in capitalism, and they operate universally. We all know this. Now, what Trotsky points out is, he doesn't use exactly these words, but this is pure Aristotelianism. What Stalin is saying here is that there is an eternal essence of capitalism, you see. Now, it turns up here in the United States, and it turns up here in England, and it turns up here in Holland, and here, and here, and here, and here. And in each case, this eternal essence was dropped into a different matter, a different environment, and therefore, while the basic strategy, that is which corresponds, the practice that corresponds to the eternal essence has to be one and the same, nevertheless, we have to be prepared to make concessions to the national peculiarities. Now, Trotsky points out, of course, that this is nonsense, that in fact capitalism, in its essence, is a worldwide system, and that the national peculiarities that Stalin talks about as modifying the operation of the laws of capitalism are in fact nothing but themselves the consequences of the operation of the law of capitalism as it develops on a world scale. So that American capitalism is not, you see, capitalism that's been modified somehow or another because it's in the American context and British capitalism and so forth and so on, but rather American capitalism and British capitalism and Congolese capitalism and so forth and so on are all simply expressions, simply parts of the development of world capitalism, and these national peculiarities are features of that development. Now, from this point of view, of course, you're not then going to think, say, you're not going to, since you've gotten rid of this abstraction of capitalism, you see, that's endlessly repeated, only with certain national peculiarities, to which peculiarities you have to make concessions. You're not going to think about it that way. Rather, you're going to analyze the thing precisely in terms of the concrete history of the capitalist development of each particular country or of each particular area under consideration. And then you're going to develop your tactics, your strategy, from that point of view. Now, if you look at it the other way, you're likely to come out, see, one of two things is likely to happen. We think of capitalism as an essence, which turns up here and there with national peculiarities. Either we're going to say, okay, capitalism is one and the same as its universal laws. To be overthrown, it requires the unity of the working class. A national peculiarity turns up. Capitalism develops in the United States. It just so happens that in the United States, it just so happens that one of the national peculiarities of the United States is that they're Afro-Americans. Now, these Afro-Americans are developing a national consciousness. But this national consciousness is clearly opposed to the unity of the working class, which is required to overthrow capitalism. Therefore, this national consciousness is totally reactionary. Or else, it's dysfunctional, that's right, dysfunctional, you see. Or else, we're going to turn the other way. We're going to say, we're going to think, yeah, now here's this essence capitalism. You see, it has universal laws and unity of the working class and so on. However, we have to make concessions to the national peculiarities in which this develops. Now, what's a national peculiarity of the United States where capitalism is developing? Well, a national peculiarity here is that there happen to be Afro-Americans who are developing a national consciousness, and a black man named Stokes ran for mayor of Cleveland. Well, we have to make concessions in terms of the unity of the working class. And so, obviously, in making concession to this national peculiarity, namely in the United States, the development of Afro-American consciousness, we have to support Carl Stokes. Now, I submit, you see, that these two things, either to declare say, the development of black nationalism or black national independent struggle and consciousness, and, you see, an unprincipled concession a fundamentally reactionary development, or to support and to politically support everything without exception that any black man does on the grounds that the laws of capitalism are applying, you see, under conditions of a national peculiarity, are both equally logical consequences of this basic theoretical error. Now, what the SWP did was, of course, quite different from both of these. That is, it developed its position on the black struggle precisely through a concrete analysis of the specific history of the Afro-American people in their development as a part of American capitalism, of American capitalist society. So that it's not here a question, you see, of making any modifications or of making concessions because American capitalism, or because capitalism, happened to develop under conditions of national peculiarities, namely those that exist in the United States. Rather, it's a question of seeing what the Afro-American people are today as an integral part and aspect of the history of American capitalism, and from that point of view, elaborating your strategy and tactics. And then you recognize, once you start at it that way, without too much difficulty, that the road to the unity of the working class and the struggle against capitalism is a varied one, you know, with many contradictory elements within it, and that one stage along this road, a necessary stage along this road, is precisely the development of the independent consciousness of the Afro-American people and its political expression and an independent party. Is that sort of the kind of thing you had in mind? In other words, I think that these kinds of questions of method really are of fundamental political importance. Let's see.
Lenin referred to dialectics as a concrete analysis.
Yeah.
That opposes it then to the idea of just abstracting certain relations. That's the notion that you're proposing.
Right. Yeah, I was partly, you see, that, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. All right, someone else? Let's see, is there anyone who... Okay, I guess second. Whoever, okay, yeah?
I would like to say something with the earlier comment you made about the possibility of arguing that, you know, Marxism or dialectical materialism could be argued to contain a continuity with the religious history or something like that. Well, I don't know. Well, maybe I didn't really understand what you meant, but it seems that if we really want to argue that way, then that would contradict the basic Marxist premise. In the first place, it's directed at, you know, dispelling, you know, that kind of attitude, a religious, you know, dogmatic and metaphysical or absolute view. So it seems that it is very important that Marxists maintain a scientific basis and try to, you know, own any connection with the religious part. You know, I don't know what exactly you were trying to do, or were trying to say when you made that comment. Maybe you could clarify that.
Well. I think if you try to disown a past that happens to be yours, you're going to end up dominated by it. Now, I think this is an important question. You say that Marxism should disown the religious past. I don't think that it is possible by becoming a Marxist or becoming anything else simply to disown your past. You are either going to comprehend it, that is, understand it and master it, or else it is going to master you no matter what kind of language you adopt. Now, I think that as a Marxist, you see, one element, when I try to comprehend and understand my past or the past of Marxism, the intellectual history of Marxism, then in fact I do not escape its historical roots in certain religious conceptions, precisely as a struggle against religion. I mean, obviously the main element of the tradition has been a persistent struggle against whatever religion existed at the moment. Now, for but it's simply a matter of historical fact that up until at least the end of the 18th century, this struggle against religion could not be carried on, could not even be stated except in religious terms. Now, I am not going to disown or to cast Thomas Müntzer out of the prehistory of Marxism because he expected the Holy Spirit to descend on earth and destroy all the lords and through the action of the peasantry establish the Third Kingdom. On the contrary, I think that Thomas Müntzer is very much in the prehistory of Marxism, you see. Now, I am certainly not asking that there be made any concessions to any kind of existing religious notions. But what I am saying is that if Marxists are going to have any sense of their own tradition, you know, of their own past, then they have to carry on their battle against religion. They have to purge themselves of religious notions and so forth and so on, exactly in a process of reclaiming from the past very, very much that was expressed and could only be expressed in religious terms. As I say, if you throw out, as one of your, you see, intellectual progenitors, anyone who wasn't religious, then you're not going to end up with anyone before 1800. Because it was impossible not to be religious before 1800, in some sense or another.
You see? Well,
okay. No, I insisted exactly, if someone wants to say it's a religious dogma, then I will say the people that he claims that is his own, that the religious dogma aspect of them is what is inessential, what is illusory. But we will claim them in our tradition exactly stripped of their dogma. And I refer, for example, to Thomas Müntzer. I mean, among other things, in his own peculiar theological way, Müntzer had what was probably the first modern theory of ideology. That is the notion that the ideas that men have that are somehow or another determined and shaped by the kind of lives they lead. Now, I think this is an important idea, and it could not have been formulated in 1520 when Müntzer formulated it, except in terms that the princes have hardened their hearts, against the people, and therefore they cannot understand what it is they are doing. Therefore, the princes cannot understand what it is they are doing. And as a result of their non-understanding what it is doing, then he thought, the wrath of God was going to descend on them. He couldn't say it any other way. But it's a crucially important concept, I think. Yeah, that's it?
Yeah. Another question on theoretical errors that our opponents. It seems to me there's a real streak of idealism in TL and a way of approaching questions. From a philosophical sense, like their insistence on the fact that you can't have, a liberal politician, on a platform because he's going to spread bad ideas among the working class. Or the worst crime of all in their book, is lying to the people. But if the people, the real social forces in there, apparently very often, are not the social forces in built up in the society, the forces, but the real, what really changes society or will change society for them is a particular set of ideas that are sprinkled around at any given time. It seems to be much more an idealist point of view, as opinions that govern the world, than a materialist point of view, a Marxist point of view. I think there are quite a few other examples of this also.
Yeah, of course, it's important not to, it's important not to go too far in the other direction. I mean, to deny the importance of ideology or of ideas and social change would be, that's the opposite. That's the typically reformist, or at least the old sort of economist error, to deny the role of consciousness in change. Anything? I guess we're supposed to stop now. Is that right?
Don't forget 9:30 tonight, everybody.
What's happened at 9:30 tonight? Oh, wait a minute. Just a minute. The beer in the cabaret will be from now on legal for 18-year-olds.